Ganley. This is NHPR News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. By 2020, 86 million millennials will be in the American workplace, with these young adults representing roughly half of all employees. But as this generation enters the workforce in droves, it's received a mixed reception from older generations. On the plus side, many employers are well aware that this group is the first to grow up using computers and is tech-savvy and quick to adapt. They've also come of age during a tough recession, requiring that they be flexible and opportunistic about career paths. But some see these same traits as downside. Millennials, they complain, have short attention spans and feel entitled to a fulfilling, well-paying job, but aren't willing to put in the grunt work to get there. However, amid all the chatter out there, there is one point being made that whether millennials are lazy or creative, unmanageable or adaptable, they're already reshaping our economy, culture, and politics. Today in The Exchange, scrutinizing millennials. And let's hear from you. Are you a millennial? How do you hear your generation being characterized? And if you're not of this group, how would you describe it? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have three guests for the hour. Joining me in studio, Professor Paul Harvey. He's an associate professor of management at UNH, who's written a lot about millennials in the workplace. Professor Harvey, nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us from New York City, David Burstein. He's a millennial writer and filmmaker, author of Fast Future, How the Millennial Generation is Shaping Our World. David, great to have you. Thanks for your time as well.
Great to be with you.
And also joining us, Paul Taylor, Executive Vice President of Special Projects with the Pew Research Center. His book is The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown. And Paul, good to have you too. Thanks for your time.
Nice to be with you.
Well, and I'll start with you, David, and maybe you too, Paul. Who are we talking about here first, David, in terms of the generation and when it was born, when it starts, when it ends? Because there's always a little fudging around the lines there.
Yeah, well, millennials are people born between the early 1980s and the early 1990s. It's the largest generation in history. There are over 80 million in America alone and billions sort of globally. And it's a generation that has come of age in a world where change is the constant reality, where we've had to deal with an incredibly increased pace of change and rate of change in the world around us. So for us, a world of fast-paced change is normal and is our reality.
Well, we'll definitely talk about that. How about you, though, in terms of the dates, Paul Taylor? 1980s to 2000 is how I've seen this generation described.
That's right. So the oldest of them is in his or her early 30s. The youngest, presumably, it's hard to have an endpoint in a generation yet. It takes a little while to figure out who the next generation is, but presumably the youngest of them is in their mid-teens. They're distinctive in a number of ways. First of all, in the United States, we are on path to becoming a majority-minority country, and this is the most racially diverse generation of young adults in our history. About 43% are non-white among kids today, 50% are non-white, so they are, in that sense, a transitional generation. They're having a very time getting started economically, as you alluded to. A lot of them came of age just as the economy went into that deep recession in the mid-aughts, and for a lot of Americans, that economy hasn't recovered. They have lived that tough time finding that first job, getting a career started. A lot of them a boomerang back home to live with mom and dad because that's the best place to hang out if you can't get started. As you say, they're digital natives. They're the first generation in history for whom all these amazing digital gadgets that are now so much a part of all of our lives aren't something they've had to adapt to. It's all they've ever known. They're nimble. They're quick with them. And in the digital revolution, it's clearly we're in a moment where the young are leading the old in terms of what are the norms, what are the rules, what are the ways that we all use these gadgets.
Well, and Professor Harvey, to you, some of us were joking. Some of us slightly not millennial people were joking. Be nice to millennials because they'll help you program your phone. But how would you describe this generation, whether age-wise or some of these cultural characteristics that our other guests are talking about?
Yeah, I think the points they've made, I've seen a lot of myself, both in terms of the research and anecdotally in the workplace and in the classroom. I think it was David made a point off the air that there's an argument might be made for splitting this generational group into kind of an older and a younger Generation Y or millennial, whatever you want to call it. And I think there's some truth to that. I've noticed that there seems to be some shifts in that older group and the younger group, going back to norms in terms of the electronics and things. For example, in the classroom, and I've talked to managers, say the same as in the workplace, they've kind of given up the fight in terms of not having a smartphone out at all times in class, on the job, you know, when it would seem inappropriate. But to take it away is such a disruption to their social order that it's just off the table. And we're kind of learning ways to work around it. So, okay, how can we let them have their laptops up and their iPads and their iPhones while also getting them to engage in whatever they're supposed to be doing at the same time? So that's just one of many kind of challenges and observations that we're kind of working through from both a workplace perspective and an educational perspective with this group.
So that's interesting. So in the workplace, older managers are saying they're bothered when people of this generation bring out their phones. Hey, we're having a meeting. Hey, you're not paying attention to me. But now they're just saying, okay, maybe we just need to live with that.
Yeah, choose your battles. And that's the one they've chosen. Okay, we're not going to win this one.
All right. Well, let me invite our listeners to join us, and then a lot more questions for all of you. The number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. You can find us on Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. If you're a millennial, how do you hear your generation being characterized these days? How do you feel about those characterizations? And if you're not a millennial, how would you define the folks in this generation, those young adults, roughly aged 15 to 30, very roughly? 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. So let's talk about the workplace, guys, because that's gotten a lot of attention as more and more people of this age group join the workforce. What are you hearing, David, from employees and employers?
Well, you know, it's really a generation that is searching for incredibly meaningful work. And this is sort of one of the biggest shifts, I think, in this generation. It's not that people haven't wanted to have fulfilling jobs and careers before, but for this generation, the overwhelming majority say they actually take a job that pays them less if they feel it can have greater social impact. So there's this quest for people in this generation to say, I don't just want a job where I can go in, check in the morning, get my paycheck, and punch out. There is a desire to say, I want my job to be part of my identity. I want to be able to say to people, this is who I am, this is where I work. You know, for the first time, we're seeing declining popularity among people for jobs on Wall Street or careers in business, because people are saying, you know, these are not professions that have gotten a good reputation in the wake of the financial crisis. So there's a lot of desire on the part of this generation to engage in meaningful work in terms of the kind of places they're working, but also in terms of the kind of contribution that they can make at a particular place, that they can actually be part of, you know, creating something, building something, having some responsibility at a particular company. And for a lot of employers, this is a new thing for them to deal with when it comes to the workplace, but something that can be tremendously valuable, because you've got a generation of people who are willing to work hard and they're willing to do great work if they are excited about where it is they're working and what it is they have to do.
And so the flip side of that, and I know the others want to jump in, but I'll just throw this at you quickly, David. The flip side of this quest for meaningful work, and I hear you on that, sometimes though work, there's some parts of your job that just aren't meaningful. It's just grunt work. You just got to do it. You just got to suck it up and do it. And the goodies will come later. What do you think about that? Do you hear that millennials are less willing to settle for that sort of drudgery that every job has some of?
I think we are finding that, and I think I actually think there's a lot of positivity to that, because what it means is when you're able to find the right fit, and I talk to employers all the time who say this is some of the best employees they've ever had, because they're willing not only to, you know, to stay long to do the work, but they actually are reflective of the kind of world that we're living in. This, I think, is the most important part of it, which is, you know, for the next several decades, millennials will make up one of the largest forces in the workforce at the same time that they make up one of the largest consumer spending forces. So the values that millennials have, in most cases, are representative of whatever the consumers or the consumer side of a company is actually looking at in terms of who they're trying to reach. So there's actually a valuable asset there. And if millennials don't find a company exciting to work for, it's probably a reflection of the fact that consumers may not find that, millennial consumers may not find that company as exciting to have a consumer relationship with.
What do you think, Paul Taylor? Your surveys at Pew, a quest for meaningful work and a willingness to work hard.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the numbers that we've seen, the millennials jump out that much. I think among young adults, generally, there may be a life cycle effect here that seeking meaning in work is associated with people just starting out. I think there have been some changes in terms of attitudes towards work, and it's part of a broader change that I think today's young adults have in attitudes towards all institutions. They don't expect the way their parents or grandparents' generation might have expected as they started out, that they'd find a job and they'd stay with a company for the duration. The notion of long-term employment is a part of the past now. So I think there's very much of a sense that you're on your own, you've got to develop your skills. If it works for you and works for the company, great. If not, move on and do something else. It's a gig economy, you've got to find your way. And I think that they're just reacting to the global changes in the economy. In terms of willingness to work hard, that's an interesting one. And I must say, as you mentioned, I have a book out and I've been doing some talks around the country. And more so than I would have expected, I hear from middle-aged people in work settings some complaints about young adults. They're just not as committed. They aren't willing to work as hard. It's hard for me. I don't consider myself an expert in behaviors inside of workplaces, and I don't know whether this is just the familiar kids today complaint or whether there is something there, but it is at least anecdotally something that's in the air.
Well, and Professor Harvey, I know you've written a lot about this. As a professor of management, millennials in the workplace, you've had some critiques too, and we'll talk about those in just a moment. We have to take a short break. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. If you're a millennial, how do you hear your generation being talked about these days, especially as this group of young adults enters the workforce? If you're not of this group, how would you describe it? The good, the bad, every generation has it. Join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. You can support this 24-hour news service by becoming a member of NHPR's Leadership Circle. Your $100 monthly gift to NHPR helps preserve independent and reliable journalism in New Hampshire. Find out more about NHPR's Leadership Circle and make your gift at nhpr.org. Mostly cloudy, some showers likely today, cooler, with highs from mid to upper 60s, temperatures falling into the mid-50s this afternoon. It'll be cloudy, chance of showers tonight, some areas of fog, lows tonight, mid to upper 40s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Lake Street Garden Center, specializing in plants grown for New England, celebrating 40 years with a new greenhouse, Lake Street Garden Center in Salem and at lakestreet.com. And from Verekai, from Cirque du Soleil, a world of endless possibilities coming to Manchester. Verekai opens June 25th at Verizon Wireless Arena. Tickets at Ticketmaster.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, meet the millennials. We're looking at so-called Generation Y. As this generation enters the workforce, we're looking at all the descriptions that have been put out there lately. 1-800-892-6477 is a number for you to join us. If you're a millennial, how would you describe your generation? If you're not of this generation, how would you describe it? 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Professor Harvey, we were just talking about some of the characteristics of this generation in the workplace. David Burstein, our millennial, says, hey, there's a quest for meaningful work. There's a willingness to work hard. Paul Taylor said that's not hard work isn't entirely what he's hearing from people when he does his research at Pew. What are you hearing?
I think my observations, again, both anecdotally and in the survey research that we've done, are probably a little bit more in line with Paul Taylor's observations, that there is certainly a bit of ambition in this group, and that does get noticed. more of what I hear has to do with kind of the lack of drive. And again, I think it's important to split this group into a kind of before the financial crisis and after the financial crisis, because I think a lot of us are noticing a difference and a group that sounds a lot more like what David was talking about post-2007 in that era. Whereas before that, when I would talk to managers, all I would ever hear about is almost the opposite of what Dave was saying.
Entitled.
There's the entitlement. There's the I'm not putting in the extra hours. I'm not coming in a minute early. I'm not staying a minute late. A real problem with that and a real drive for the paycheck above meeting, in fact. And it was a real frustrating thing both for professors who are trying to point students in a meaningful direction and for businesses who are trying to hire people that really believed in what they're doing and wanted more than just a paycheck. Now, that said, after 2007, more recently, we do seem to be seeing a shift towards a quest, especially for more meetings. So I think David's right in that point. And I think a lot of the points that he made, the hit to the reputation that the traditional money-making careers had taken in 2007, 2008, probably have a lot to do with that. So I think even within this millennial group, we're seeing a shift. And I don't know that it's entirely fair anymore to group the entire, you know, bunch of 80 million people together, because there does seem to be kind of an intra-generational shift within this group.
Very interesting. And it just shows you in general, and everybody, you know, agrees with this, it's hard to characterize a whole generation. There's a lot of people.
Especially
there.
80 million of them.
There's, yeah, 80 million is a lot of people. Lots of people on the phones with us now who want to jump into our conversation. The number 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, let's go to our listeners. Jillian's waiting in Hudson. Hi, Jillian. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm 27, and I just was wondering about how your guests thought that, you know, going through the financial crisis so early in our careers affected my generation. So, you know, a lot of my friends lost their jobs, that either the company closed or they downsized. And, you know, I think that personally it just made me realize that, you know, your friends and family are going to be there for you, and your job, you can't always count on to be there for you.
Yeah, it kind of brings you back to basics, doesn't it, Jillian?
Yeah.
And, you know, Professor Harvey talked about this. What do you think, David Burstein, the effect of the recession on this generation happened right in the middle of everything?
You know, I think one of the interesting things we've seen is it's produced a pretty strong sense of resilience on the part of this generation. I mean, this generation has lived through the what in some ways we could describe the fail decade of which the financial crisis comes at the end of, but where we've seen our biggest institutions, whether they're, you know, government and educational institutions, economic institutions, businesses, fail and not live up to what we would hope them to be or what they've been in previous generations. So one response to that could be, you know, gee, the world is a crazy place with all these institutions failing, with rogue actors, you know, roaming around. I don't know, you know, what I should believe. I don't know what I should be afraid of. Is the world safe? You know, I'm just going to go and be in an every man or woman for themselves mentality. But instead, we've seen this desire to contribute to positive social change, to try and, you know, fix problems that we have in our world, this deep sense of idealism, a desire to help each other, a desire to fall back on friends, peers, family. So the response to all this has been one, I think, of real resilience, which has sort of taught people in this generation, gee, if we can go through these experiences, we can do anything. And I think it's led to a lot of the entrepreneurial spirit in this generation that says, you know, if these things aren't here, I may have to go out and create my own opportunity. A lot of these things are sort of have come back at this generation, I think, as strong values of being able to just get up and do what's necessary.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you, Jillian, for the call. Here's an email from Kelly. She says, born in 85, I'm a millennial. Some would agree that millennials have a sense of entitlement in regards to entering the workforce. But, Kelly says, the issue I see is that youths went into college with the rose-colored glasses of our parents' generations, expecting that when we graduated with a degree, work would fall into our laps just as it had for them. Kelly says, when I graduated with honors from a state college in 2008, not great timing for you, Kelly, there, it was not easy to find any kind of work. I continued to work at a coffee shop before landing an entry-level office position that paid less than I made making coffee, but with the promise of advancement. Kelly says, yes, it was grunt work, and I believe that I, as many of my peers, felt extremely disillusioned. What had I just spent 4 years of college for? Why was I now carrying a degree that was as meaningful as a mere sheet of paper with my name typed across the top? These feelings, she says, I believe are very rampant among my generation. What have you heard, Paul Taylor? Thanks a lot, Kelly, for the email.
Well, it's really fascinating because one way to divide this generation is between those who have gotten their college degrees and those who haven't. A record share of this generation of young adults does have a BA degree or more, about a third do. While there's no question that for people who got their college degree around the time that she did, and many of them, let's also add to the fact, many of them have come away with student loan debt, which is at record levels now, $1.2 million in student loan debt. The typical college graduate has about twice the student loan debt that that was the case a generation or so ago. So you're starting out in life without the economic opportunities you thought you would get and the albatross of having to pay a lot of money back. That is a very tough road, and it's reasonable to think that these young adults will be scarred economically by that for decades or more down the road. That said, however, if you compare how well they are doing with how well the two-thirds who haven't gotten a BA degree, what has happened over the last few decades is that the gap between the two has gotten bigger and bigger. And it's not so much that the college grads are doing better. They aren't. They're barely holding their own. It's that those who haven't gone on to college are paying a very, very stiff penalty in a knowledge-based economy. And those are the people who are suffering the most. And that's where the unemployment rates among young adults are by far the highest. And that's where levels of poverty and debt are very high as well. So it's interesting. The question of income and wealth inequality has been very much in the news in the last several months. You see it very dramatically within this generation with different economic outcomes. And unfortunately, the economic outcomes, whether you have or haven't gone to college for this generation, at least so far, haven't been great. They are the first generation. We don't know how their story ends, but we know how it's begun. And they are this far into their lives. Again, the oldest are 33, 34. They're the first generation in modern American history that at this stage in their lives are doing less well than their parents' generation.
Thanks a lot for the email, Kelly. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. This one's for you, David Burstein. Why does it feel like there's been a lot of piling onto this generation lately? I mean, can they really be any more flawed than the boomers or the Gen X? Or are older people just feeling crotchety?
We have this cycle that we go through every time we have a generation of young people. In fact, you go back, you look at almost every generation of young people over the past several decades has been called the me generation, starting with Tom Wolfe ascribing that to the boomers, and actually some people even calling previous generations that. And so it's not particularly a new phenomenon. We tend to look at young people the same way, sort of in cycles, and then later, as they get older, they get rehabilitated. A lot of it, I think, has to do, actually, at this particular moment, with the way that our media narratives are written. There's never been more outlets for communicating a message about something, about a cultural trend. It's never been more easy for trends to spread, for one magazine cover or one article online to get carried in so many places by so many people of different generations. So we see a much bigger effect. If the New York Times or Time Magazine, as they both have done, writes a piece sort of criticizing people in this generation or praising them, it gets a lot of traction and a lot of attention and goes a lot of places and ricochets very quickly and lives forever. And also new is that we are living in a culture that is more receptive, particularly online, and perhaps this is changing, to negative memes and negative trends, which can have that sort of effect going down. So there's a lot of data on both sides of this argument, but it's what's happening is there's a big cultural trend, which I think is potentially starting to push the other way, sort of criticizing this generation. And I think we see that playing out in mainstream and sort of offbeat media outlets.
Yeah, it's easy for things to get amplified and shared a gazillion times over. And, before we go back to our listeners, I did want to ask you about that too, Professor Harvey. Now, David's our millennial, you told me before the show you're almost a millennial, but you're more Gen X, okay, born in the late 70s. I have read that Gen Xers are especially harsh on millennials. And again, I joked earlier that that's because we baby boomers know that millennials will help us with our technology. But why do you suppose that is?
I think each generation tends to be most critical of the generation that comes right after it. Yeah, I think that's probably a phenomenon that's played out throughout human history. So I think we're just kind of seeing that play out yet again. And I think Generation Y will probably be hypercritical of whatever follows them. And if you go back through history as far as we know it, each generation seems to kind of overcorrect the mistakes or the perceived mistakes of the generation before it. So we constantly have this pendulum of every generation thinking they can do things way better than the one before them. And they kind of make some corrections, but they overcorrect. And then the one that follows them corrects those overcorrections. So I think that's just natural.
Well, it's interesting. I had a conversation with a couple 15-year-olds yesterday who just barely might qualify for this generation. And this one friend of my son's was complaining about all the video games that this fourth grader was playing. And, you know, I thought, wow, okay, that's the pot calling the kettle black. But whatever, I your point is appreciated. Let's go to Angie in Peterborough. Hi, Angie, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you guys?
Fine. Go ahead, Angie.
Well, I was calling just because I am part of this generation that you're talking about. And I myself have actually described some of my generation with the more harsher characteristics, I suppose, such as entitled. I feel that a lot of my generation, especially the later part, feel entitled, if only because I grew up in a family where I was expected to work for everything I have, and they didn't really buy any of the accessory things like having a cell phone or a car. And I've heard from previous schoolmates back when I was in high school even that they expected their parents to pay for everything.
So you describe your generation as entitled and spoiled, Angie.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how do your friends feel when you tell them that or express that?
Some of them agree, and I wouldn't say that all of them are entitled or spoiled, but I think there is a large portion that come out of it.
Good to hear from you, Angie, and it's good to hear from millennials, too, you know, talking about how sometimes they agree, sometimes they disagree with these characterizations. Here's an interesting email that just came in from Liam, who says, growing up, I was told I could do anything. I got awards for 11th place in sports. Everyone gets a trophy. I was told all I had to do was go to college, then I could do anything I wanted for good pay. A family and home would follow. And then crushing college debt that all other generations don't seem to understand is commonplace. We are the most educated workforce America's ever seen. And people wonder why some of my generation is still stuck living with parents, like it's something we wanted to do. Now, here's Liam's main point. I want to share this with you guys. He says, my generation didn't create the housing crisis. My generation didn't inflate the cost of health care. My generation didn't strip the earth of its continents, leaving a climate mess. My generation didn't ask to work two part-time jobs that didn't need a degree 20 years ago to do it with a college loan payment that costs almost as much as a mortgage. Liam says, I can only hope we'll somehow leave the next generation better, not worse. So what do you think, Paul Taylor? A lot of resentment. And when people say, hey, look at all these 20-somethings living in mom and dad's basement, Liam's saying, not our fault.
Yeah, I think he puts his finger on an unhappy reality of the modern American and global economy. There have been big shifts, and whether it's the digital revolution that it's not clear is going to create as many jobs as it destroys, or whether it's the globalization of labor markets or other things, standard of living has been flat in this country for 10 or 15 years. The middle class is getting smaller, and this rising generation coming into the workforce has lived this, experienced it in ways that he describes. What I do find interesting, however, is that while there is a little bit of an edge there of generational complaint, saying in effect to his parents and grandparents' generation, boy, you guys have left a mess for us, we find very little, in the surveys that we do, we find very little generational conflict or rift over these kinds of issues. And now I speak as a boomer who came of age in the 1960s, an era of a lot of social and cultural protest, whether it's civil rights, whether it's women's rights, whether it's anti-war movement, and there was no question there was a whiff of generation war in the air, you know, don't trust anybody over 30, and you know, the feeling that our parents had screwed things up and we were there to make it right. among today's young adults, there's no question, I think they've inherited a big economic burden, but they don't seem to be blaming their parents. Indeed, from our surveys, they have a lot of respect for their elders, and they clearly, within the context of their families, they get along with their parents, and there is a lot of young adults boomeranging back home. You know, a lot of young adults have migrated from being the children of their parents to being the roommates of their parents, you know, somewhat seamlessly. So there is a surprising amount of good vibration between the generations, at least in the family context. And frankly, the hope is that you take some of that and you translate it to some of the public policies, you know, that do put the younger rising generation at the short end of the stick and say, look, let's try to rebalance these so these kids have the same opportunity to thrive that all preceding generations did.
Well, Liam, it's great to hear from you. Let's go to Tom in Greenfield. Hi, Tom. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, thank you. I have four sons. My youngest two would be millennials. The oldest two would not be. And I think there's really no generational difference. The oldest two have the same technology skills as the youngest two do. I think it's how they're raised by their families and their parents, where they get their influences from. And I think the generational spread is quite a bit distorted about, you know, being a big difference between one generation and the next. They all have different skill sets. They all have different abilities. They've been successful in different types of ways, have different types of families. But I think it all comes from their upbringing and not from what generation they land in.
So,
the same as the baby boomers.
So it's all about the parenting, Tom, and how you raised those boys. And congratulations for raising four boys. That's great. How you raised them, not necessarily generational trends.
Yes, exactly.
That's what you're saying. Yeah, I wonder what you think about that, Professor Harvey. People are shaped, obviously, by their parenting, but there's other push and pull that are shaping
people. And that is a big part of it, like you said. And you know, there's a lot of us that have been digging through the sociological literature trying to find out, you know, where this, how this generation got shaped. And obviously, parenting styles have a lot to do with it, but we think also educational philosophies that came into vogue in the mid-70s going into the 80s also have a lot to do with it. And in a lot of ways, again, you know, overcorrecting the previous generation, it seems as though some of this came from a desire to kind of create a generation that was more, that was happier, if you will, than Generation X, that often has this reputation of being kind of grumpy and unambitious and having given up on life before it even started.
Speaking as a Gen Xer.
Yes. So there was a push in parenting theories as well as educational theories to try to build up the self-esteem of kids so that they could, you know, form a healthy sense of self before they got beat down by life. And we may have gone a little too far with that in both the parenting and the educational side of things.
Interesting. So you are special and, you know, you're great and you win an award for 11th place in sports, as Liam says.
Right.
All right. Well, a lot more conversation in just a moment. We're taking a look at millennials on The Exchange. Stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, reaction to Ukraine's first presidential election since the toppling of the government. Then, debate over laws that give terminally ill patients access to experimental drugs. All coming up on the Ian Rehm Show.
The Ian Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Mostly cloudy, some showers likely for today. Cooler, with highs from the mid to upper 60s, but falling into the mid 50s this afternoon. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Gibson's Bookstore in downtown Concord, welcoming children's author Paul Durham on June 5th at 5 to share The Luck Uglies, the first novel in his new middle-grade fantasy adventure series. And from the New Hampshire Trust Company, a locally owned and managed firm providing trust and investment management services throughout New Hampshire, online at nhtrustco.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, with tick season in high gear, we'll check up on Lyme disease. Join us for that conversation tomorrow on The Exchange. Today in The Exchange, a closer look at the millennial generation. And let's hear from you if you're a millennial, roughly described as born between 1980 and 2000. Join us. How do you hear your generation being talked about? How do you feel about the characterizations of your generation? If you're not a millennial, how would you describe this group? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. You can also find us on Twitter Center. Before we go back to our listeners, David Burstein, I did want to hear from you, too, as a millennial. We heard from a listener about parenting styles and how much of a difference that makes. And Tom seemed to say, look, it's all about the parenting. But there are influences. Parents are influenced by cultural shifts. Schools influence kids and how they're raised. What do you think, David Burstein, about parenting styles and how it affected your generation?
Well, I think all of those are parts of the equation, parenting, sort of the experiences we've had as a generation, and education. On the parenting side, I think it's worth noting that the parents of this generation, in large part, are baby boomers who came of age in a time where there was our first really major shift in the way we thought about family units and family hierarchy and what the family was for. You know, my father's parents, when my father went off to college, he did not have a long ongoing daily relationship with his parents. He went off, he chose what he was going to study. He called home maybe once every couple weeks and basically checked in for a few minutes to say, is everything okay, good. I went off to school and talked to my parents on a regular basis. They knew what I was studying, they knew what I was thinking about. For people of my generation, the relationship between parent and child, of friendship, of actually being able to share things in confidence and gain advice and support on things, that would have been totally foreign to most people in terms of their relationships with their parents, in my parents' generation. So I think that a lot of it has to do with the fact that this generation has raised us in a lot of the values that are behind the cultural shift that happened in the 1960s, which I think is one of the reasons we see a lot of this desire, particularly on political change and social change, coming from this generation, is very reflective of the fact that these are things that our parents' generation fought for and were part of down the road.
So a lot closer to your parents than they were with their parents.
Yeah, definitely. And it's actually amazing how close. I mean, the amount of contact children have with their parents today, which again, some people might perceive that in a negative light. I actually think it's a good thing. I think, the relationship of having someone in your life who's a trusted, mentor, advisor, companion, I think that's really, really important. I think that parents can absolutely play that role, and we should be celebrating the fact that parents are playing that role.
Yeah, although I've also heard from employers, Professor Harvey, that some millennials come to job interviews and say, wait, I got to get my mom on the phone.
Yeah, I could spend the whole hour talking about those kinds of stories. And especially when this generation first started hitting the workforce, it really baffled employers and interviewers that, all of a sudden the interviewee would stop and pull out their phone and find out the mother's been on speakerphone the whole time.
Oh, dear.
The stories are crazy. But, I think especially coming from, again, the Generation X perspective and being baffled by the generation that follows you, that is kind of something that's really fascinating to us, the intense connection that a lot of these individuals seem to have with their parents. I just had the opportunity to spend 4 months on a ship with about 600 of them, teaching with a semester at sea. And every time we get to a port, every cell phone would pop out, and the first call I'd see these kids make was to their parents. And they would talk for half an hour before they get off the boat. And it's kind of nice in a way to have that connection with the parents, but it's just baffling where that's usually been thought of as a rebellious age. And they really have a healthy, some might say too healthy, but a very strong connection anyway with their parents.
Well, I so remember a long time ago we interviewed an author who said that it was a book about helicopter parenting, if we can call it that, Paul Taylor. And the guy said that the number one reason college students used to go to the school psychologist was because of a breakup with a boyfriend or girlfriend, and angst about that. Now the number one reason college students go to see the college psychologist, is they can't cope and deal without mom and dad. What do you think, Paul Taylor?
Well, this is
parenting styles, how they shape this generation.
Well, there's no question. Parenting styles matter a lot. I do think modern parenting styles, perhaps to some degree, have been shaped by an era of global terrorism, of school shootings, of the fact that the internet can be a place full of predators. There is a protectiveness. There's no question of nurturing, help our child fulfill himself or herself. There's also a protectiveness that has led to, I would say, a great deal of wariness on the part of young adults. I'll tell you one statistic that has jumped out at us. We ask a survey question other researchers do. It's called the social trust question. It's a very straightforward question. Generally speaking, would you say most people can be trusted or you can't be too careful when you're dealing with other people? This question has been asked for 40 or 50 years. Millennials have come in as the generation with the lowest amount of social trust, and just 19% of millennials in our latest survey say that most people can be trusted, only about half the share of older adults. I do think part of that may be these protective norms that has led to a kind of wariness. It's a difficult world out there. You are a precious soul. Your parents told you that, but you can't be too careful. And I think in a fast-moving economy, social trust is sort of the grease that keeps the gears from grinding, and the wariness may be useful to protect young adults from the perils out there, economic and otherwise, but it may also inhibit them in terms of a sense of adventure and entrepreneurship and all the rest.
Interesting. What do you think about that, David Burstein?
Well, you know, I mean, I haven't seen that particularly, and I think that one of the things that's interesting when you look at this generation is one of the places they are putting a lot of trust is in each other. I mean, you look at the rise of particularly technologies that 10 years ago, 20 years ago, would have been thought unthinkable. The idea that when I'm going to go on vacation, I'm going to stay in the home of a stranger and someone that I've never met before on something like Airbnb, or I'm going to pick up a car from someone I've never met before and hitch a ride somewhere. The idea that people are willing to make those kind of leaps, which before would have been thought unthinkable, at a time when our trust in government, in media, in financial institutions, in our political leaders is at an all-time low, I think one of the bright spots is that people are actually showing a willingness to trust each other. They're putting more faith in their friends and their relationships. And there's really this sort of increasing distrust of the elites who used to care a lot what the reviewer from the New York Times said. Now we care more, what do people like me say online? What are the opinions of people like me? How is this going to be reflective in the kind of things that I'm interested in? So there's a little bit of a push, I think, back in the direction of falling on each other as opposed to falling on bigger institutions to necessarily make these decisions for us because we've seen them fail so much. So I think as we go forward, there's a lot of positivity that comes from that, people willing to make community among strangers, among peers, and build that. I think that has a lot of potential as we go into the next decade.
Well, yeah, and looking back at some of the big events that happened to your generation, we talked a lot about the recession, but David, you talked about the elites. Certainly when you were coming of age, the Catholic Church was going through the child sex abuse scandal, and Wall Street was falling down, and we heard about, what some of those folks did, pretty unsavory. So I hear what you're saying there.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It's not an apathy towards these institutions. It's a calculated assessment of where we could best spend our time and who the players are, and we sort of say, is this really where our time is best spent, or should we go back and help, build better institutions, build institutions in a different way, and then come back when institutions are, the bigger institutions have matured, have learned their lessons, have led by example.
Let's take another call. This is Jane in Manchester. Hi, Jane. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Good morning. I just wanted to say, as someone who is older and has worked with millennials, what I find most discombobulating is that they have a very hard time being process-oriented. They are social media-oriented, and I tell them that they're, quote-unquote, doing their lives all day long at work. If they've had a fight with their boyfriend before they came to work, the texts are flying back and forth, and that fight continues all day long. They are communicating with people all over the world all day long, about a number of different issues, little mini dramas in the family or whatever is going on socially. And if you combine that with poor written skills, many of them cannot write well, and some of them are dedicated pot smokers, it gets to be a very challenging environment for an employer.
How do you work through that then, Jane?
You have to keep your sense of humor, I'll tell you that. It's quite challenging, and when you approach them with the most minor rebuff, perhaps, about the length of time they're spending on their cell phones, they look at you they're very perplexed by it, as if you maybe...
You're a dinosaur.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And you have to struggle with this all day long. Even if you try and get some eye contact to explain a project that has to be completed by the end of the day, you're not getting the eye contact. They're looking at their cell phones. And it's frustrating. And I think the older you are, the more frustrated you are. And I think that employers have some real issues on their hands.
Well, let me ask you a question, Jane. And I'm of the generation where, I'm kind of perplexed when we're in a meeting. And, you know, we were in a meeting recently, a big meeting, offsite with other people. And about half the people around the table had their phones and they were looking at their phones through this meeting. And about half, mostly the older people, were not. And I said to one of our millennial staffers, who's absolutely wonderful, I said, gee, a lot of people are on their phones during that meeting. And she said, yes, Laura, but they were contributing, they were listening, they were making points. Half of them were looking stuff up relevant to the topic while they were talking. And she kind of made me rethink that, Jane. What do you think?
Well, I'm probably the wrong person to ask, because I hate technology. I'm worse than the Unabomber. I hate technology so much. So, you know, it is difficult for me, so I try and remain, you know, game about the whole thing all day long. But I do not see it abating at all. I really see it, especially when you have games, people are playing games, and, you know, or they're playing little poker games, stuff like that is so recreational. In addition to all the social stuff, it just gets to be a little too exhausting to address it all the time. So
well,
I do
Jane,
back
thanks.
Down.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling in. Here's an email from Earl in Newfane, Vermont. He says, having taught graduate classes, I was appalled by the nerviness of students of this generation to question your grading, asking to redo projects, change grades, complaining to administrators. Many of my students were no doubt hardworking, but their sense of entitlement and not to be denied is very unsettling. Professor Harvey, have you encountered that same sort of pushback? How dare you give me a C?
Oh, yeah. And that is kind of the genesis of my interest in the area of psychological entitlement. Again, I think I've seen a drop in the last few years. Maybe this is a post-recession thing. Maybe it's not. I'm not sure. But I think that's a reflection, again, of educational philosophies that this group grew up with, that there was always a chance to redo things, that in the end you were going to get the passing grade, even if it took 20 tries to get it right. So there's this idea that, hey, you know, I got this bad grade. One response is to criticize the source of the grade and say you're wrong. The other response is to say, okay, so what do I do to fix this? What are we going to do next? And the idea that there is no next, this is the end, try harder next time, is not something that goes over well.
Well, it's interesting. And with my older kid, I have noticed that some of the teachers say, you know, you didn't do so well in this assignment. You know, you'll get a little more credit if you do a redo. And at first I thought, well, you messed up. But then I thought, well, wait a minute, if he messed up because he doesn't understand, maybe that's okay.
Yeah, and you can really argue it both ways. And in that scenario, I think it's a justifiable way of doing things. You didn't understand, we want to get you to the point that you understand. But unfortunately, so many today, and this is every generational group, you know, we view grades as the reward, not so much the knowledge as the reward sometimes. Even though we tell ourselves we don't, there is that tendency. So it's how many times do I have to do this till I get an A or at least a B? Not so much how many times do I have to do it till I understand.
Well, let's take another call. This is Peter waiting in Littleton. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hey, the longer I've listened to the conversation, the more I've gotten lost. I agree with just about everything that everybody has said, and I do believe that there's two sides to everything. Being a business owner and a millennial, I don't see any fellow millennials out there running businesses, starting businesses, taking risks, making investments. So there does seem to be some kind of a gap between, moving forward and being a millennial. And yeah. I don't know what it is.
Well, that entrepreneurial spirit, I think we talked a lot about that earlier in the show, you know, born of recession and people saying, I can't depend on these institutions. I guess I'll depend on myself. Thank you, Peter, for that call. Here's an email from Anne-Marie. She says, I'm 46, not a millennial, recently left a career of 20 years because my company became a place that devalued women. She says, I am optimistic that this new generation has grown up with more diversity that will bring more equality for all to the workforce and world. Amory, thank you for that. And Paul Taylor, you're the one who mentioned earlier, I think this is the most diverse generation ever.
It's the most diverse racially and ethnically, and also in terms of gender norms, they are very different. I mean, just to start with college going, in my era, again, I'm a boomer, 55-60% of college undergraduates were men. Today it's reversed. Nearly 60% of college undergraduates are women. When we do surveys of young adults about their life ambitions, we find young women are actually more career-oriented these days than young men. One of the things that's happening on the gender front is a sharp decline in marriage among young adults. Today, among millennials, only about a quarter are married. You go back to their parents' and grandparents' generation at the same age, 50 or 60% were married. I think a lot of this has to do with young women who have made the calculation that let me get my ducks in a row first in terms of my own economic circumstances, economic foundation, and maybe I'll find a partner down the road. Frankly, a lot of it is that particularly young men at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale aren't making particularly attractive marriage partners. There's a lot of issues around, marriage used to be something that young adults started soon after they got through their education and they went forward in life together. More and more marriage happens much later in life after you do have your economic ducks in a row, but there's just less marriage going on because so many young adults are struggling economically and they feel like they're not ready for it.
Well, Paul, that's a whole great other show that we should explore later in life marriages. Paul, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate being with you.
That's Paul Taylor. He's with the Pew Research Center. David Burstein, great to have you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Burstein, he's the author of Fast Future, How the Millennial Generation is Shaping Our World. And Professor Paul Harvey, it was great to have you. Thank you also
Thanks
for being
for having
here.
Me.
Paul Harvey, Associate Professor of Management at UNH. Congratulations are in store here on The Exchange. We've just reached our 1,000th Facebook like. If you haven't liked us yet, doing so will let you see what's coming up on the show. Get more access to information like today's extensive Pew report on millennials. So like us on Facebook. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, the latest on Lyme disease. This tick-borne illness has been steadily increasing in New England, and this spring promises to be another active season for Lyme, which can cause muscle weakness and joint pain to more serious conditions, including heart problems. We'll talk with experts about the most recent thinking on this disease. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where we get support from you, our listeners, and from Ralph Young and Pignatelli, with law offices in Concord, Nashua, and Boston. National Impact Uniquely New Hampshire on the web at RaffLaw.com. And University of New Hampshire at Manchester, accepting applications for fall 2014. More information online at manchester.unh.edu.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. On Sunday, in the first election since the toppling of the government, Ukrainians elected Petro Poroshenko as their next president. The country's new leader, also known as the Chocolate King, is no stranger to Ukrainian politics, and he's